From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Well, the former Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan was sentenced to 7.5 years in federal prison. He's also been ordered to pay a hefty fine. That's after his convictions for corruption. We're going to talk about that and more coming up on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Professor Emeritus and former Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime reporter and observer. And our guest this week is Ray Long, investigative reporter with the Chicago Tribune and author of The House That Madigan Built, a book about the rise and the fall of the former speaker. Ray, it's always good to have you back with us.
Great to be here, Sean. Thank you.
Well, last week on our show, we had to record the show before the sentencing, which came down late on a Friday, so we really didn't get to talk about this case and what all happened and the legacy of Michael Madigan, so a good time to do that this week. And Ray, you have been following Madigan for years. You wrote the book we mentioned, and you've certainly been following this corruption case. Finally, the sentencing happened. I want to get yours and Charlie's reaction to the sentence that was handed down. I'll start with you, Ray. What did you think?
Well, I thought that it was very interesting because the judge went through an hour and 45 minutes before he went to the sentencing or to the arguments of the prosecution and the defense. And the focus of the judge was how Madigan's actions amounted to opportunities and actually amounted to giving him enhancements to the penalties. And the judge actually said, well, you know, we could do 105 years based on all the enhancements, but of course nobody there, nor did the judge even consider that. But the long windup to going through all those enhancements and pointing out all the reasons he thought that Madigan was deserving of a stiffer sentence included things like saying, you know, when you took the stand, you lied, sir. You did not tell us the truth. You didn't have to do this crime. And the prosecution had argued in its briefs that he was worth more than $40 million. So that enhanced the idea that he didn't need it for the money. And he didn't really shake down people for money for himself, except for his efforts to try to win more real estate business. And so the judge, I think, was interesting and made a point that for folks who follow Chicago politics will find somewhat key to this. The judge said he looked at Madigan as participating in this years-long scheme from 2011 to 2019. And when I covered the Burke case, Ed Burke, the former city councilman who was there for a record 54 years himself, the judge focused on just the period of the alleged crimes. And that was a much shorter period than what they had for Madigan. And the judge in the Madigan case also said that this was a period where ComEd had estimated that they could make at least $400 million more dollars in shareholder equity by passing the laws that were passed. Madigan's folks said, well, we didn't give them everything they wanted, but that wasn't enough to sway the judge either. So I went in thinking that it would be more than the Burke sentence. I wasn't sure if it was going to be as high as 7.5 years or 90 months. But when the judge was talking about it, I thought he may go for 10 or 12 himself. So he kept it in, kept the courtroom in suspense about how long he was going to sentence Madigan. And then, of course, he threw in a $2.5 million fine. Mm-hmm. which was more than the prosecution asked for. The prosecution had asked for 12 and a half years and a $1.5 million fine. The defense, Madigan's team, asked for 5 years of probation with the first year in home confinement. So I had a feeling it was going to be a stiff sentence. I just didn't know how far they would go.
Yeah, and Charlie, you were surprised by the length of the sentence as well. And let's remember, Michael Madigan, I believe he's 83. Is that correct, Ray? 83 years old?
Yes,
I mean,
83.
So to get a 7.5 year
in April.
Yeah, so a 7.5 year sentence is, you know, for somebody that age, too, is quite severe. But Charlie, your thoughts as well on this?
Well, I was surprised that it was as long as it was. And one of the reasons was, and Ray, you alluded to this, in the case of Ed Burke, I believe he was sentenced to 24 months in federal prison and fined $2 million.
Right.
And he was convicted on charges of racketeering, extortion, conspiracy, et cetera, et cetera. And so I figured that if Burke got 2 years, Madigan would maybe get 3 or 4. And also, reading the judge's comments, it seemed like he was almost conflicted. He talked about what a decent, kind individual was, Madigan was, how considerate he was. It was like almost like a tale of two Madigans. One was this very good individual, dedicated public servant, good, decent person. And in the judge's words, he had no reason to commit these crimes, but he chose to do so.
Right.
And as you pointed out, I thought also it was probably a mistake for Madigan to get up and testify himself. And I think, didn't the judge refer to it as some kind of a nauseating display?
Yeah, he called it nauseating. He had a hard time watching it. And part of that really included how Madigan had basically downplayed heavily things like his relationship with Mike McLean, the longtime lobbyist, former legislator, ComEd lobbyist, and really a confidant of Madigan. They had been close over the years, and Madigan didn't exactly acknowledge that by any means. He referred or made it sound like Mike McLean was just kind of an acquaintance, and he came in and used the conference room next to my office, but I have an open door policy. Well, anybody who knows Mike and Mike Madigan's way they ran the office, they didn't have an open door policy for anybody to come in and just use the conference room anytime they wanted. So there were things that, and the judge really spelled out in specificity how Madigan one time was inquiring to Mike McLean about how McLean could work ComEd to get Mike Zalewski, 23rd alderman, the dad of the former rep, Mike Zalewski, a job, a contract through Jay Doherty, another lobbyist, who was convicted in the ComEd 4 case, and use Jay Doherty as a way to funnel ComEd money into the pockets of four of Madigan's allies. But the judge went through how Madigan called or talked to McLean on the phone about getting Zalewski on, how McLean reached out to ComEd. They had McLean's phone tapped, and how he talked to Ann Promajori, the CEO, who also was convicted in the ComEd 4 case, and how they talked to Fidel Marquez, who pleaded guilty in the investigation, and how McLean actually said okay for $5,000 a month, and Fidel says okay, and then McLean calls Mike Madigan back and says okay, the deal's done. So that made the judge convinced that Madigan was not only a key player, but had coordinated a part of the scam. So between that and also the convictions involving rogue alderman Danny Solis, the 25th Ward alderman who got jammed up in his own bizarre case, you know, Solis was brought on to wear a wire on Madigan, and he helped bring down Madigan and Burke too.
Charlie, when I look back at this, we just touched on the fact that Madigan taking the stand, we had talked about that on the show when it occurred, and a lot of people scratched their heads, thought that may not have been a great move at the time. Was this just, do you think, a situation where Madigan, who I think has always viewed himself, and many have viewed him also as the smartest guy in the room, maybe he thought he was smart enough to get past this, to do this, and maybe change the case in his favor? It seems to have blown up, though, on him.
Yeah, I think it did. And part of it was, as the judge said, that he lied. He perjured himself in doing it. And I thought at the time of the trial that Madigan was, in a sense, he was kind of throwing Mike McLean under the bus. It was like, well, McLean was this independent operator, and I didn't know what he was up to. And I thought to myself, man, that's not going to ring very true.
Yeah, I think you're on the mark there, Charlie. I felt that when I watched Madigan on the stand, he was, you know, his typical cool self, and he spun out these answers that made some of his statements that were caught on tape sound fairly innocuous, but the prosecutors argued they weren't, and the judge didn't buy it either. And so even though he was, you know, a guy who was well-practiced, he'd been under fire for years on tough questions from reporters and knew how to handle tough situations and could answer in his kind of calm, very well-spoken way, but it just didn't ring true.
One of the things also that surprised me, and Ray, you had it in a story, I don't know if it was Sunday or Monday, how Madigan really went into great detail about his personal life, how he grew up in a family where there was no love and his father knocked him around. And I thought to myself, reading this, was Madigan attempting to explain himself in terms of his upbringing? Was he trying to kind of move which was sympathy because he had a rough time as a kid?
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting and kind of unusual approach in a political corruption case. Basically, I had a tough time growing up, and that explained why I gave kind of short answers and brushed people off. In the case on tape, he would be found saying mm-hmm or yeah, but he said, and those would be answers that the prosecutors would seize upon to show that he was aware of various angles of the scam. And his argument there was that he was non-confrontational because his dad had been a very stern father, and one way to kind of get through various interrogations and confrontations with his dad was to just kind of slough off the dad's answers with mm-hmm or yeah. And he was saying that was what he was doing when he was given some of the answers that the prosecutors said showed that he had accepted or was knowledgeable of what was going on. Now, what was interesting is that there were, you know, more than 200 letters, and many of those letters in support and calling for mercy for Madigan said he was a man of his word. Well, the judge said, okay, that cuts two ways. If you're a man of your word when you want it to sound good, that's one thing. But if you're saying that you're not a man of your word when you're just sloughing off with mm-hmm and yeah, that's quite another thing too. And he didn't buy that you could be a man of your word one time, but not when you don't want it to be. So the judge had a harsh view of that excuse. And that was one of the things that backfired with Madigan on the stand.
When we talk about somebody of Madigan's age, the years he's put in to state government and to politics in Illinois, and now this is how it ends. So I guess when I look at it, trying to figure out his legacy, Charlie, I'll go to you first because you've known him longer than Ray has. What do you kind of see as Mike Madigan's legacy? Will it's going to be remembered for this case, for these convictions, and having to go to prison?
Yeah, and this certainly has tarnished it, but I would argue that on balance, his legacy would be positive. And I was honored enough to write a foreword to Ray Long's excellent book on Mike Madigan's rise to power. And at that, I said that from my observations of Madigan, and I first met Madigan, it would have been in late 69 when he was a delegate to the Constitutional Convention. And then I followed him all the way through, either as a reporter at the Sun-Times for 24 years, or then as director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program until he left the speakership. And I thought he was motivated by a couple of factors overall. One was he wanted to protect the city of Chicago and its institution against the suburban interests that were trying, for example, to take over O'Hare Field, that kind of thing. And he also wanted to protect the legislative branch against what he viewed as encroachments by the executive branch. Famously, Jim Thompson would issue amendatory vetoes and Madigan would not consider them. And then a little later, what Thompson tried to do with the amendatory veto, there'd be legislation introduced that would do the same thing, but it would go through the normal process. So that was my basic feeling about Madigan as speaker. He had no personal agenda. He wasn't somebody who was lobbying for this or lobbying for that, but he was looking to protect the city of Chicago. And for that, he needed to have Democrats in a majority in the legislature, and also to protect the legislative branch against governors who wanted to overreach. And I'd also say it was to his credit that he basically engineered the impeachment of Rod Blagojevich, who was, without a doubt, a very corrupt individual.
And Ray, your thoughts on Madigan's legacy?
Well, just to pick up on Charlie, if you don't read anything else in my book, you ought to read Charlie's foreword. But the reality is that you got to look at him through a political lens too. And he, because of his mastery of politics, he was able to survive remap when Republicans had drawn the districts. And he was able to extend the number of Democratic seats in both congressional remap and in the legislative remap and bring it to what was then a record number of Democrats in the House. I believe it was 74 at his peak. Now it's 78 because they've pushed the lines even harder and farther now under Chris Welch and Don Harmon. But Madigan will be remembered for everything, for trying to stick close to helping labor, standing up to Bruce Rauner when Rauner was trying to turn Illinois into kind of a right-to-work state of mind. And he will be remembered for standing up, like Charlie said, to Blagojevich. And when Blagojevich was trying to do all kinds of wild, crazy financial moves, Madigan stopped him. And he was more or less a guy who had veto power because he controlled the House, even though he was in the legislative branch. Major issues and programs had to go through him. He could forge the sides together when there was a concealed carry order from the federal court, and concealed carry had never been allowed in Illinois. Illinois was the last state to allow concealed carry for guns, and federal courts said, Illinois, you have to do it. And it took Madigan sitting down with all sides to try to pull it together. Quinn actually vetoed the final package, and Madigan had put together the votes to override it, and they did override it, and what he eventually forged was law. He also worked with Greg Harris, the legislator from Chicago, who was pushed the gay marriage bill and helped Greg Harris round up votes there. And Madigan was a key guy who stood up and said, "We need more money, and here's the income tax we need." But it always had to go when he thought it was ready to go. So, famously, in 1989, he pushed a surprise income tax through after he had opposed Jim Thompson, the Republicans' plan for 2.5 sessions. And then Madigan, in a blitzkrieg, probably the biggest power play I ever saw, was pushing through the House with 60 votes and income tax, all 60 votes, Democratic votes. And he left the Republicans stunned, not sure what they should do, because they had backed Thompson for an income tax increase. But then this was Madigan's income tax increase. And of course, he'll be remembered for the famous time that he and Thompson worked together to hold a few extra minutes so that they could push the White Sox stadium bill through. But he will be also remembered for, his ties to labor, his ties to the trial lawyers, and just a secret operation, more secret as time went on. He was much more available in the early years, as Charlie has gone over many times. But this conviction, if he cannot get it overturned, is going to stain his legacy, and it will stain his legacy even if he does get it overturned. You know, the courts are liable to weaken the laws like they did the bribery statute earlier. But I still think that he's going to have this political black eye over him, no matter how it plays out.
Oh, yeah, I agree with that 100%.
Well, let me save a couple of minutes here to talk about just what was really just an awful story that occurred out of Minnesota. A lawmaker and her husband shot and killed in their home, another lawmaker and his wife wounded. The suspected shooter appears to have been politically motivated, and there were notes that were found that included names of other officials, including some from Illinois. Charlie, this, as I said, shook a lot of people who are in elective office and in the public eye. We've seen situations happen like this before, political violence. This seems to be as dangerous of a time as any I can recall.
Yeah, I can't recall anything like this either. And I think one of the differences is when I was a reporter covering stuff, and Ray, when you would cover the legislature, or Sean, people could disagree on policy, and they could be standing up on the floor of the House hollering back and forth at each other. And then later that night, you'd see them out at a restaurant eating together. And we may differ on public policy, but we're not enemies. And now there seems to be more of a sense that if you don't agree with me, you're the bad guy. And there's more personal attacks. There's more the political rhetoric tends to dehumanize people who don't agree with you on an issue. And so you have this atmosphere where I'm a politician, and I would describe Ray, who's on the other side, he's not just wrong on the policy, but he's actually an enemy. He's evil because he doesn't agree with me, that kind of thing. And that encourages, I think, the lunatic fringe to take the kind of action that happened up in Minnesota. One of the things that I wonder, because here in Illinois, the home addresses of candidates are pretty much available. Anybody who wants to go to the Board of Elections website and look them up, because I've done it in the past to figure out who is running in what district. And I wonder if there's going to be a move afoot here to kind of limit the availability of that information. Maybe you would have to file a Freedom of Information request to find out, well, Wheeler's running for the House, where does he live? That kind of thing.
Yeah, good point.
I don't know.
Yeah, Ray, just about a minute or so here. I want to get your thoughts on this as well.
Well, I do agree. We've gone beyond the point of just civil debate by any means. This is not Lincoln Douglas territory we're in right now. We have gotten to the point of hate, and hate makes people do things that are are bad. And I think that we're fed by misinformation machines, and the misinformation machines call out the folks who are actually doing real news and doing it to the utmost level of integrity. They get labeled the fake news by the folks who are actually sending out information. And so people get confused. I mean, it's not up to Joe Lunchbox to sit there and try to sort through all the facts. They're depending on what they read or what they see on TV to be accurate. Unfortunately, the profiteers of misinformation have muddied the waters, and we're all suffering from it.
What would read or see on TV, in my mind, the rise of the internet and things like Facebook and WhatsApp and some of those others, where you find yourself isolated, you follow the posts of people who agree with you, and you get totally one-sided information. And I think that's really a big change from the days I was an active reporter.
And it seems like there's a push for more security for elected officials. You can understand that. The problem you always run into with that is it seems to take them even further away from their constituents. And that's not necessarily a good thing for democracy either, but we'll talk more about that in coming shows. Time now for our notes from the field. Ray, we'll start with you.
Well, I'm going to wait and see what the judge will do. Federal Judge John Robert Blakey still has a decision to make here as to whether Mike Madigan will be allowed to stay out of prison while his case, his appeal, is pending. And so right now he's scheduled to go to prison on October 13th, and his defense team will do their best, I'm sure, to try to keep him out as long as possible.
And Charlie.
Well, one of the things that happened this week was Governor Pritzker signed the budget for the coming fiscal year, which starts on July 1st. And one of the interesting items in there was the appropriation from the general funds, which is the state's main operating account, for the Attorney General Kwame Raoul is increasing by almost $16 million over what his current appropriation is, or his current budget is. And the reason is that one of the things he cited in testimony before one of the House budget committees was that he has an increased workload coming from more than a dozen lawsuits his office has joined challenging actions of the Trump administration and defending the state against legal actions the administration has filed against Illinois. And his quote, "This budget will support supplying the requisite attorneys to step up where the federal government is stepping away, as well as attorneys involved in critical cases to protect our state's interests." And that was his quote. So his budget got a boost when many other agencies were and other constitutional officers didn't get any increase, and there were cuts in some areas.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler and Ray Long of the Chicago Tribune. Look for State Week where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.